Hello everyone and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers and I'm joined by Gail Schimmel.
Hi Fiona.
Hi Gail, how has your writing week been?
Oh Fiona, so we've had a little bit of a break between when we last spoke and now.
Mm-hmm.
The listener doesn't feel it, but I am feeling it. Because I was in a good writing groove. I was being, I was doing my words a day. I was in the groove. I was prioritizing it. I was doing all the things. And then I went on holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And now, for me, holiday is often a very good writing time. And I often write more on holiday. And I did write a little bit on this holiday, and I was pleased with how much I'd written because it was a very run around, do busy holidays. So there wasn't a lot of writing time, but I used that time I had and I was happy with myself. And I've come back and I've lost it. I've lost that ability again to go, just because I have a busy work day doesn't mean I'm not writing. I've lost my ability to say the email must wait until the words are done and I'm writing the email first and I'm letting the work worries pour in before I let the writing happen. I've written a little bit this week.
Okay.
So I'm not entirely fallen off the wagon, but I'm not writing my 500 words a day, and I'm letting writing be at the bottom of my list of priorities, and I need a kick in the ass, but I don't know who's going to give it to me. How about you?
I am still working on my literary novel. But an interesting thing happened to me a few days ago, which hasn't happened in a while, which is I got a new idea. And that is, it can be a lot of fun, and it can also just be a passing phase. And I don't quite know what this is. Is this something that is going to go somewhere, or is it just going to drift off, never to be thought of again? And I don't quite know how I'm meant to tell the difference between them. Do you know how to tell the difference?
So I'm very lucky. I have magical hands and I get a tingle in my palm when it's a good idea. Sometimes that tingle leads me completely astray and sometimes I don't get it. But I do think that the idea that stays with you is the one that has legs. You know, when the characters take up residence in your brain and they're talking and they stay there for week after week, and sometimes they're at the forefront, but sometimes they're at the back, but they're there. That for me is when you know. And I have had it recently also, that a new idea and not a me idea came to me. And they took up residence and then they left. They seem to have come back, I'm relieved to say, because I have to finish the book I'm writing before I'm allowed to write anything more.
Right, right. I do allow myself to work on more than one thing at a time, but I'm already working on more than one thing. So whether I add in a third is a different question. But I think this is, it's a seed. It's very much at the germination stage. So you think I must just sit with it for a while and see if it sticks around.
And see if it grows. See if those characters come, if they start chatting.
Okay. Well, have anybody else's characters been living in your head? In other words, what have you been consuming lately?
Fiona, they have been living in my head. I'm dreaming about them. I am obsessed. I'm watching Severance. I had no idea what Severance was about. I thought it was a Wolf of Wall Street type program.
Okay.
I don't know why, because I knew it was about the workplace.
Yes, yes, yes.
And then I took a long flight, and there wasn't a lot that caught my attention in the many, many things there were to watch, and I watched the first episode of Severance. And, oh my goodness. So Severance, for those of you who don't know what it's about, is based on this idea of people go to work and their work persona is severed from their home persona. So they have an innie and an outie, and an innie is the them that goes to work. And it is a personality that, when it starts, is born in the workplace and knows nothing about their outside self.
Yes.
And is free of memory and free of personality. And then they have their outside self, who is the personality who they've been their whole lives, but has no idea what's happening at work. And then you have this I know you have watched it.
I have.
Right? Have you talked about it? Have you told me to watch it?
I have, and have I you? Did. And I think it was my little voice in your head that made you click on it on the airplane.
I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was. Yeah, and what have you now that you have finished watching Severance and your life must be very empty as a result? what are you filling the space up with?
Well, we interviewed Alistair Mackay, and he mentioned that he was reading Butter by Asako Yuzuki. And he gave it a strong recommendation, and I know it's very much in the zeitgeist at the moment, so I read it. And it is so extremely interesting. It's a novel about a Japanese journalist who becomes obsessed with a woman who may or may not be a serial killer, who is now sitting in prison awaiting some kind of appeal of her sentence. And she wants to be the one journalist who lands an in-depth interview with this woman. And her friend says to her, write to her and ask her for a recipe. Because this woman is very much obsessed with food, the one who's in prison. And she says the way to a woman's heart when she's a real foodie is through her recipes. Ask her for a recipe. And that does prove to be her in. And she starts having these regular meetings with this extremely interesting, manipulative woman and delving into her history and her background. And it becomes a kind of meditation on what it means to be a Japanese woman and your relationship with your own body. The extreme prizing of being slim, very, very slim, and having a very controlled relationship with food. And this woman who's in prison, I mean, people are almost more outraged by how much she loves food than by the fact that she might be a serial killer. And the journalist starts changing her own relationship with food. And it starts off with butter, how you feel about butter. And there's a butter shortage in Tokyo at the time. It is fascinating. I don't think there is a woman on earth that it would not speak to. No. It's so interesting. Possibly was a bit longer than it really needed to be, but that is a minor criticism. It honestly is one of the most interesting things I've read all year.
Okay, I'm definitely going to have to move that up my to-be-read list.
Well, someone who writes books that women of all ages and types can definitely relate to is our guest today. Our guest today is Zebu Sithole. Zebu is the author of The Thing with Zola, I Do, Don't I, and now most recently, Love Zola, all published by Pan Macmillan. Zebu was longlisted for the Sunday Times Fiction Prize for The Thing with Zola and the Sala Debut Prize also for The Thing with Zola. Zebu is a journalist and has written for TV and radio. Zebu, we are so excited to have you in the studio today. Hello and welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Zebu, you know what's going to happen now? We are going to ask you to tell us about your writing week.
Sure, my writing week has been hectic. I've had deadlines, but I've also been so exhausted. We're coming close to the end of the year, and the brain is drained.
And when you are writing, like when you maybe deep in a novel, tell us what your daily process looks like and your weekly process.
So my process doesn't actually change depending on the deadline. What does make deadlines more hectic is the rereading. Mm-hmm. But the writing doesn't change much because I've made it a goal of mine to write at least 2,000 words every morning.
Wow.
So I wake up super early because I also homeschool my son and try and get the writing bit out of the way, whether it's a journal entry or just rambling, because I do, I am a rambler. Mm-hmm. So to save everyone from my unwanted opinions sometimes, I choose to just write it down. It doesn't have to go anywhere, but just the practice of writing, it makes it so much easier when you have to write, when you've already got the habit down. Mm-hmm. Then when you have to write, it just comes more naturally. And it's also been so amazing for my vocab. Because you have feelings that you can't put into words, And then now, because you want to put it into words, you Google it, you look it up, you find the word, and you later find it flying out of your mouth like you were born saying it.
And is that the time where, if you're writing a novel, if you're in that novel writing process, is it part of those 2,000 words in the morning?
It is sometimes. It is sometimes. But sometimes the novel is a different thing because I want to get the things that are on my mind off my mind so I can focus and zone in. Because writing romance when your life is not romantic can be difficult, you know? So you need to get the unromantic stuff out, you know, put on the right playlist, kind of riz yourself up, get in the mood, and then start writing those love scenes.
So let's say you've done your 2,000 words about real life and getting rid of the bad feelings.
Yes.
Now you get to the novel writing part of the day. What would your aim be in that time? How many words would you try and get? How many pages? Is it a time thing for you? Do you write every day? How does that work for you?
So for Love Zola in particular, I was feeling really emotional as I was writing because it is the end of a series. It is my first series. It's my debut as myself. So there were a lot of emotions, a lot of thoughts going into it. And the story itself is quite emotional because it's a woman coming of age, coming into herself and making these big decisions about her life. And to a certain degree, I'm at that point too.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very emotional. So a lot of it was I'd write until I can't write or until I feel tapped out, like I'm exhausted, it's time to take a break. Then I'd stop writing.
And would you ever write in the afternoons or evening after work, or is it only confined to the morning hours?
My schedule is usually very flexible, except on Thursdays when my son has swimming at 4. but otherwise, I work from home. I'm a freelancer and I homeschool, so I can usually just move things around. We can start lessons at 6 in the evening if we want. We can do a lesson on a Saturday and give him a Wednesday off instead. And yeah, I think being more flexible has allowed me to be more creative. It's also forced me to have to let a lot of things go.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're a freelancer, you don't earn regularly and you don't earn as much as you would if you worked 9 to 5. So I've had to kind of decide what is important to me. And because for the first part of my career, it has been making bank and not necessarily writing what makes me happy,
mm-hmm.
and writing articles I'd be proud of. And now after COVID, obviously everybody had a rude awakening, like the world could literally end at any point. Would you be happy with the life you've chosen to live? And for me, the answer was no. So I chose to change my life and make it more flexible, allow me myself to be more creative and express myself in a way that makes me proud. And should I drop dead one night, if somebody were to Google me and find the things I've written, I'd be looking down or haunting from a corner and being like, yes, that is me. So yeah, that's where I got the flexibility from.
That's amazing. Okay, you've touched on it, but one of the things I'm really curious about is when I Googled you and saw the things you're proud of, I saw that you are a ghostwriter of romantic novels. Now, I know about ghostwriting somebody's biography. Explain to me what a ghostwriter of romantic novels does. How's that different from a writer of romantic novels? Talk us through that.
So there are a lot of people who want to be known as romance authors but cannot write. And
for the listener, I have a look of absolute bewilderment on my face. Like, huh? If you can't write, you don't get to be a writer.
It happens. They have an idea of a book, but they can't make it 80,000 words.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So a person can come to you and be like, okay, I want a romance novel where Cinderella and Snow White, for instance, run off together after they decide the princes are totally worthless.
Nice.
And they don't know how to get from A to B. And my role would be to take them from A to B. When you ghostwrite, you are writing under someone else's name. Mm-hmm. That means they're very involved in the process. Yes. And it takes much longer than writing your own work, because when you write your own work, you are the client, you are the producer, you are the everything. But having to kind of mesh your minds on an idea, it's a very involved process. It takes much longer. And romance is sometimes used as a euphemism for erotica. And a lot of the novels I've written where people come to you wanting a romance novel, it actually turns out that they want erotica, which a lot of people are ashamed of. You know, you don't want to express yourself and your sexual fantasies. And, well, tell me and I'll do it for you.
That is so interesting.
I'm amazed. And do you not feel like I would be really resentful? I would want, it's a co-writing arrangement. It's not a ghostwriting arrangement. It's a co-writing arrangement. You should get credit for it.
You know, I believe very much in serendipity. And I feel like I have learned lessons without knowing I was learning lessons. And when you work for TV, for instance, you're used to not getting credit.
Right.
Because everybody talks about how actors get royalties and all of that. And I am a storyliner for TV. You write the actual story. Everything, it's your brainchild. But once you've gotten your 10,000 rand for the month, that's it for you. Mm-hmm. While people who perform, who are literally your colleagues, everybody wants them to get royalties. Nobody cares about you. Your name appears in small letters for like 10 seconds at the end of the thing. So it's not really about the credit for me. I gave up on credit a long time ago.
So a client approaches you with an idea for a romance novel. Mm-hmm. What sort of a contract is then drawn up between you and that person whose name is going to appear on the book?
The most important thing is the NDA.
Mm-hmm.
So while I can say I'm a ghostwriter, I can never tell anyone who my clients are, what I've written for them, and I'm perfectly okay with that. What is important for me is saying that the NDA works both ways. This was your idea. I'm not taking credit for this. I'm not going to market your book. I'm not going to say anything about your book. I will not post it on my social media because that is your work. Those are your ideas. The only ideas I will take credit for and take responsibility for are my own. So there's the NDA, there's the payment agreement, and then there's the work schedule. Mm-hmm. So when are we checking in? How much can I expect you to read in a week? How much do you expect me to write in a week? And it needs to balance. You can't expect me to write 10,000 words in a week when you can only read 2,000 words in a week, because I need the feedback so we can get the process done as quickly and as seamlessly as possible. So there's that. And what else do we talk about? Oh, we talk about what a client wants, like specifics. There are some clients who will tell you that I need the couple to meet right at the beginning of the book. Within the first 1,000 words, I need the meet cute. Or they'll tell you, I specifically want the woman to have curly red hair and this man needs to be obsessed with it. Or I need them to speak about scent a lot. I need it to go around how everything smells, like the smell of coffee, the smell of her hair, the smell of her pillow, the smell of his jersey.
I think you stop before you get into too many smells.
Yes. Could easily go too far.
And how did you get into this work?
So I got into it after I was retrenched from my newspaper job, which had become very stressful. It was 2021. Everyone was tired. Everybody wanted a change. I got retrenched and I was like, thank goodness, because I didn't have the courage to leave, because I'm looking at the bills I have and everything I've got set up. And if I leave this job willingly, I'm going to have to move out, go back home. I might have to sell my car because keeping a car when you don't have steady income is a lot, because the insurance is a steady expense. Upkeep of the car is a steady expense. So I was thinking money. So when I got retrenched, it gave me a break to think, okay, now that I haven't been given a choice, what do I want? And I did eventually have to move home. I did eventually have to sell my car. I did have to start over, but from a happier place that I wouldn't have noticed before. And that's how I got into ghostwriting, when I was scrolling through LinkedIn and I was like, okay, since we're not looking at money anymore, let's look at what makes you happy. Let's not look at journalism for now, because that has been a thorn in your side for years. Let's look at writing. Let's look at something creative. And they had ghostwriting, no experience needed. And I was like, perfect, wonderful. And through this company, it worked kind of like a middleman, an agency.
Is it an international thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, there's a lot of Chinese interest. And yeah, Chinese.
So I must now stop looking with suspicion at all the South African romance writers and suspecting you have written all their books. This is an international project you've been doing. Projects. You submit
wow.
No comment. India.
Wow. So yeah, it was through a company at first, and then I figured out a way to contact and meet clients on my own and moved that way.
So have you always been that little girl who wanted to write? You knew you wanted to write, you became a journalist and then moved into creative writing, or did that come to you a bit later in life?
It's always been a thing that I first looked at as a hobby, because I wanted to be a social worker. I wanted to be a child psychologist until I met a child psychologist. And geez. And then I wanted to be a lawyer, and then I wanted to be a journalist. But I've always written, because my parents always kept us reading. My parents were big on reading. They read themselves. We had a lot of quiet time. It was when, you remember the TV aerial with the bunny ears?
Mm-hmm.
My dad would hide it. And without it, you can't watch TV. Like, my brother would try, like, stick a hanger in there and all of that, but it wouldn't really work. So that was the sign, a signal that it's reading time. And my dad would be like, I wonder where it's gone. It's gone missing. And then we'd have to read. And after my mother had a stroke and became a quadriplegic, we started spending more time at home, just the four of us. And we'd get bored, because my parents would be like, it's family time. Like, we're all going to just sit there together and do what?
And they've hidden the bunny ears.
And they've hidden the bunny ears. Like, what do you want from us? And we've read all the books you've bought. Like, are you buying more books? What are you doing? So my brother and I started writing stories for each other. So we'd write and swap and write and swap. And I always thought of it as a hobby. And because you don't think something that makes you happy can also make you a living. Mm-hmm. It's not, it doesn't seem natural. It's like, it's too good to be true. And yeah, I've figured it out. Like, I've found the secret of life.
So then you decide that you are going to write in your own name. What triggered that decision, and how did you then go about changing your process to write a novel as you?
It was peer pressure, 100% peer pressure, because I didn't think I was ready to explore that. Because when you start writing, the biggest thing writers face, the most frequent experience we have, is rejection. Because you'll write and you'll submit your story to 10 places and 11 will say no. Even people who haven't read it, they'll preemptively say no. And I didn't think I could take that. So a friend of mine who was also a ghostwriter, she was like, I saw on Twitter that Pan Macmillan is looking for black women who write commercial romance, and I think you could do it. I was like, I don't know, I can't. And she nagged at me. She'd send texts, she'd call, she'd inbox on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, until I was like, okay,
this is a good friend.
Okay, she's a brilliant friend. So I did, and I submitted my name and thought nothing would come of it until the commissioning editor, Zodwa, called and was like, this sounds great, let's talk about your story. And that's where the thing with Zola came from. So it's all kind of like a giant jigsaw.
And did you originally write it thinking that it was a standalone novel with a sort of happy ever after ending, or did you always have in mind a trilogy?
It was a long standalone romance novel with a happily ever after. And obviously, when you're working with a publisher, you're working with people who know a lot more than you do. They've got experience. They've got teams that know how the markets work, what sells, what doesn't. And with their guidance, we split it into three novels that changed over time. The storyline is completely different to what I originally thought. It's even different to what I had in mind at the beginning of this year. So it's, ever-changing.
Well, that leads to quite an interesting question about how much do you plan, how much comes to you as you write. And especially, you know, with a romance novel, there are a limit to the things that can happen. You can't do what we can do. We can kill somebody in the middle of the book if it gets boring. How much do you plan? How much do you just let happen in the writing?
I plan a lot, but I don't know how to stick to a plan.
Okay.
So I'll sit there and I'll plan everything. I'll map it out. I have my character Bibles. I have mind maps. I have timelines. And I write none of it. So, yeah, I plan a lot and execute none of it.
And do you think that planning process still helps you write the book?
I do think it helps me, especially the character Bibles, because once you know who a person is, because this is a fictional person. This person literally doesn't exist. So you need to create core values for them so that you know what they are capable of, how they move. Otherwise, it's easy to just lose a character for the sake of the story. Like somebody who can't hurt a fly suddenly becomes a serial killer because you need something interesting to happen in the book. The character Bibles kind of keep you true and keep you from inserting yourself into the story a lot, which I was tempted to do because I'm seeing young black women in love and I'm thinking, I wouldn't do that, I would do this. And the character Bibles kind of reminded me, this is not about you. So,
interesting. Yeah, the thing about a traditional standalone romance novel is that the focus stays very intensely on the main couple and how they get from the meet cute to actually the happily ever after. So if you take it beyond that, and now you're dealing with a romance trilogy, you've got to, I imagine, fill your world out with the stories of other characters. Were those characters always there? Did you always intend them to be as big as they turned out to be? Or did that come later?
They were always there, and the story has always been about love in general instead of just romantic love. It's a rom-com because it's the central theme, but it's been about love in general and change and growth. Because let me actually get to the essence of it, actually. The thing with Zola is a book that I wished had existed. Because when you read black romance, it's always centered around trauma. There's always the abuse and the death and the rape. And I feel that fiction also has a responsibility to be aspirational. And I wanted to fill that gap for myself and people who think like me. It might not be millions and millions of people, but there are people who want to read that, who want to see a soft love and know that it is attainable. And with the soft love comes the different types of soft love, the different types of healing and relationships that come into that romance of yours. Because when you fall in love, it's not just about you. There's your best friend who hates the guy. There's your mom who wants to know more and wants to insert herself into the relationship. There's his ex, there's his mother, there's his best friend you hate. love is just complicated, and it just pulls so many people in together that usually would have nothing to do with each other. So the thing with Zola and the Zola series looks at that and looks at healthy relationships, healthy dynamics, and the drama that can happen in a healthy way.
I love that. And for young black women to have that aspirational, it doesn't have to be trauma and disaster, that it can be beautiful and normal and healthy.
Exactly. You don't have to earn love through pain and tragedy. You just deserve it for existing.
I love that. You've talked a bit about being careful not to insert yourself in the character, but you've also told us you wrote the romance book you wanted. How much have you made it into Zola?
The snobbishness and a bit of her stubbornness, because the Zola at the beginning of the book is me just after I finished varsity. A lot of that is me, where you've got your nose in the air and you grew up in this very township. But being there, you feel like, oh my gosh, what are they doing? What are these township peasants doing? When you are exactly what they are, you are them. And it was kind of a mirror to my face, because I didn't realize I was writing myself. It took a relative being like, is this not you? Is this not how you behave? And I had to look back and I was like, oh yeah, it is. I'm so annoying. I am so annoying. But that's about it. That's about it. Aside from the fact that we are both black women from the township who found themselves accidentally by mistake back there and had to start over and were better for it. There are no real other comparisons.
I mean, that sounds like quite a big comparison.
Starting to sound like an autobiography.
Autobiography with wish fulfillment.
So how have your readers responded to the soft love that you've presented to them? I presume that your readership has hit the target market. They are mostly young black women. What feedback have you got from them? Are they enjoying the softer view of romance?
It's been mostly positive. My interactions with people who read the book are mostly on social media, because after reading one negative review, I decided my heart couldn't take it. It was one guy who was like, is this even literature? Because for him, he's been conditioned. Mm. Literature needs to be black struggle. If you're seeing black people in books, they need to be impoverished and recovering from apartheid. Like, if you don't say apartheid, you don't say politics, you don't say struggling to get clean drinking water, you've missed it. Is it even literature? And literature doesn't have to be serious and sad, and it doesn't need to leave you like crouching on the ground, crying in the shower. You don't need to be traumatized. You can, and I think everyone should, read for pleasure.
Mm. Mm. I'm nodding so hard, my head's going to fall off. And it's making me think, for me, I have a particular book that made me realize South African writers were allowed to write books that weren't about suffering and trauma and apartheid, and if you write about how guilty you feel about it all, and that you're actually allowed to just write nice stories. What was that book for you? Did you have a book where you're like, I'm actually allowed to write a fun book?
I didn't have one particular book, but I realized that when reading books that I did like, the suffering and all of that, it made me want to put it down. And the chapters I enjoyed most were the happy chapters and all of that. There is, I read actually one book, and then the rest of the series I watched the movie, which is like a terrible thing to say. But Cynthia Jele wrote Happiness is a Four-Letter Word.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That for me was absolutely brilliant. And she did it in a time when everyone was so obsessed with trauma and pain, and especially women's suffering. It's like a type of BDSM. People get so thrilled by women suffering and crying. And even in the breakup, you'll have two chapters about how she writhed on the floor crying, her mascara, like dripping down her face. Nobody does that to men. Men have to be strong. They need to be the provider. They need to be charismatic. And we need to be wilting and falling apart every three lines, which is just ridiculous. And we're the ones who are buying and reading this, like conditioning ourselves to, I don't know, are we going to enact that in the real world? So Cynthia Jayle had these professional women. They had things were working out for them. And because it's a rom-com, their complication is their love lives. Mm-hmm. And that was beautiful. It translated well on screen. It read well on the page. And it made me happy. It mm-hmm. made me happy. I want to read things that make me happy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. You bring in other countries into your Zola books. There's an aspect of Germany. There's an aspect of Kigali is mentioned. Are these places that you've been to yourself and are part of your own story, or was that research that enabled you to bring them in?
Most of the travel I've done has been for work, so it's very limited, and a lot of it was research. But the imagination allows you to travel so far. When I was, I think, 7, my dad traveled to Dubai and he came back with all these pamphlets. And me and my brother got so obsessed with the Burj Al Arab. We'd like look at the pictures all the time. And then my dad started buying us books on it and the construction and the architecture. And then the internet came. And my dad didn't allow us to access the internet, so he'd Google the things we wanted and print it out. And that was the Google search. My dad was our Google search.
Your parents sound extraordinary.
My dad was our Google search, so we'd tell him what we wanted to Google. He would Google and he would print, but we were not allowed near the internet. And we obsessed over it. We saw it, and I have it in my mind so vividly, you'd think I'd been there. Yeah. And because a lot of my target readership don't have the luxury of constant and consistent travel, that element is me sharing my imagination. We're doing kind of like, I don't know, brain transfers of I've seen it, you see it, you can go there. And also seeing a young black woman going around the world, enjoying herself. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. Mm. And I wish it for everyone.
I love that. I'm finding you very inspirational. I want to talk about rom-com tropes.
Yes.
How do you feel about them? Are they a useful tool? Are they something you try to avoid? And do you have any favorites?
They are useful because nothing is really new under the sun. Everyone is disappointed in Happily Ever After. Everyone is disappointed in a surprise breakup. So it's cliche because it's what happens. It's what happens. There's a formula to romance. And trying to escape it will only secretly put you back into the formula. You'll be back in there and you just won't know it. But there is a formula, and like it or not, we all kind of follow it. I find them useful. I do not like the billionaire trope because it plays a lot on power and manipulation, and I don't think that's something we need to romanticize, especially not in Africa.
And your favorites?
My favorites, maybe because I am a romantic, I love love so much, and I'm a single mom, but I do like the accidental blended family.
Nice.
Because that's a newish trope.
Yes.
But we're seeing it a lot in the movies, in the books, where this guy is the fake dad to the kids, and then everyone falls in love and they become a real family. I love that. I'm a sucker for that. It doesn't always leave room for a lot of romance and drama or storytelling, because telling story with kids involved is difficult. It is so difficult. Like, do you write the child voice or not?
Yeah.
Those types of things. But I, when it is done, I will read it. I will watch it. I have watched all of the movies. I will read all of the novels and just like sit there and be like, oh, yes.
Let's talk about your chapter structure, because I found that so interesting. First of all, that your chapters have titles.
Yes.
Mm. And also that they are so short and kind of Moorish, like you just want to keep reading them. Tell us about that. Did you get any pushback from the publisher about having titles for the chapters? How did it all work?
There was no pushback. I didn't know publishers could have issues with that. But I like giving names to chapters. I think it's something I learned in TV. I wrote for Sia van der Laan for a few years. Mm-hmm. And that is why my chapters are structured like episodes. They play out in the mind like an episode. We are so conditioned to watching and consuming that way that a little bit of familiarity makes it easier to come out of your comfort zone. So people who watch soapies can read my books more comfortably because it's like an episode of a soapy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that makes sense.
And naming a chapter, because I'm very much a, it's called chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. How do you go about naming a chapter without doing a spoiler?
Once I've figured out what the chapter is about, then the name kind of just comes naturally.
So do you, in the writing process, do you name it and then write the chapter, or do you write the chapter and then figure out its name?
I name the chapter first because that tells me when to stop the chapter and start the next. Okay. Because now I know this is what this is about. So this is the chapter. And then once I start talking about the next thing, then it means it's the next chapter.
That's so clever.
Now I want to talk about point of view, because this is something that has changed in romance novels. When I was a teenager and reading romance, the whole story was told from the woman's point of view. It was her view of the romance, and the only thing we knew about the man was through her eyes, you know, the way he acted towards her. And then it changed so that we started getting the woman's point of view and the man's point of view, and sometimes in alternating chapters. So the whole story would be told from two different points of view. And you do tell from Zola's point of view and Mbali's point of view. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that switch happened, and do you find it a good way to tell a love story?
I think it's because our idea of romance has changed. In the stories we used to read, the Sweet Valleys, because I think that's romance to a point, the woman's perspective only mattered because she has to have the personality, she needs to prove herself worthy, where the man just needs to be handsome and rich. That's all you need to know about Prince Charming. He's handsome and he's rich.
Right.
How he's rich, why he's rich, what he does in his spare time, none of that matters. It starts even as far back as fairy tales. What do you know about Prince Charming? You don't even know his name. He matters that little. All he needs to do is be rich and handsome. And we expect a lot more from men and our partners in general now. We need them to have a personality. We need them to do something. And the attraction needs to be equal. Because you don't want to chase. You don't want to be the only one wanting and he's just sitting there like, come and I'll have my pick. That is unattractive to the modern woman. Now we need to have his yearning as well as hers. And sometimes he needs to want it more. Mm-hmm. Because for women and in our reality, it matters more in the fantasy to be wanted. Because the romance we read, we don't want to read our best friend's diary who got dumped like us last week. We want the fantasy. That's why we're reading the romance. So his yearning is the fantasy for us. Him chasing, him thinking about you constantly through the day. You want to know that. It feeds into it and it just makes the book more whole and just serves the purpose better. And I think it is for the good. We should have both perspectives all the time. And yeah.
And Prince Charming never had any weaknesses or vulnerabilities.
Exactly.
And now the modern male characters do.
He just swoops in and decides, I pick her, and then she celebrates.
Yeah.
We don't want that now. We don't want that. So we should not write that.
I'm interested also to talk about writing about Johannesburg. So you write about the exotic places, but you also write about Johannesburg and about township life. Were you ever tempted to choose a more romantic setting, or is Johannesburg where your heart is?
Johannesburg is not where my heart is.
Isn't it?
No. Oh, my goodness. It's where my body is. But because I wanted it to be real, you know, I didn't want her to fall in love on an exotic island when my readers are not on an exotic island. They are taking a taxi to work and having the door fall off in the middle of the Joburg CBD while the taxi driver shouts at them. And if they are to relate to Zola, she needs to be living in their world, sharing their experiences. Zola is meant to be the friend with a slightly more interesting life.
And where is your heart, if not in Joburg?
My heart is in Cape Town.
Oh, really? I'm sure our Cape Town listeners, of which we have many, will be pleased to hear that.
So let's talk about another thing that has changed in romance novels, and I think in life. The end goal was a happily ever after, but preferably marriage.
Hmm.
And for many women, they sort of peak ambition was just to be married, to be happily married. And in your trilogy, there's this ambivalence about marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And Zola and some of the other female characters are not all that sure that this is their peak ambition to be married forever. And they think very, very carefully about the implications of being married. Is that a new thing in romance novels? And do you think it's a new thing in life for women to have these serious second thoughts about marriage?
I think it is. It was coincidental that the statistics about the dropping birth rate came out the same week as my book.
Totally a coincidence.
It's a coincidence. I did not tell the women to do this. But we're starting to question what marriage means. Is it a trap? Are women being trapped in servitude? Because it's 2025 and he's not going to bring home the bacon and let you cook it. That's not how it works. You're both bringing in the bacon, but you still have to cook it, then wash the dishes. Is this really what you want? Men hold most of the power in the workplace, and a lot of them are there because they've got wives backing them up at home. Yet when they interact with women in the workplace, they don't take that into consideration. The people who decide how much women earn know that women are underpaid because they live with women, they interact with women, they're related to women, and yet they put that same struggle on the women they meet in the workplace. So when you consider a partnership with a man that you will earn less than, but still have to pay your own way and still look after the house and still look after him and still go to, for me, because I'm Zulu, still go to his family's house when they have imisebenzi, when there's like cultural or traditional get-togethers, and you're washing cow intestines while he's sitting there. They've slaughtered, which is like, it's a big job, but it's one job. We are cleaning the meat. We are cooking everything, dishing up for everyone, making everything and cleaning Is it worth it? Is it balanced? Is it really what you want? Is it really happily ever after? Or were you happy on one day while you were wearing that white dress and now you've trapped yourself in a miserable existence?
With cow intestines.
With cow intestines. And I'm a pescatarian, so can you imagine the horror?
When we were talking before we started recording, you told us that you have a Nigerian publishing deal.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that, how it happened, what it involves, and how Nigeria in particular happened?
So when you think of African literature, 90% of what you think of is Nigerian literature. South Africa has its own strengths. We can argue about the music, but we can never argue about literature. The best books I have read are mostly by Nigerian authors. Mm. So when my publisher told me there was a Nigerian publisher who was interested in my work, I was over the moon. Mm. And I mean, I looked them up. I saw Cassava Press has a new, is reviving the Ankara Press imprint. And my series is going to be the first to be published under the new imprint. I was super excited. Yeah. I looked up the founders, and Bibi is super amazing. What she's achieved in her 20 years at Cassava is absolutely amazing. And the fact that her focus is on taking African literature to the world, it's like, I don't know, is she my fairy godmother? Like, who is this woman? Because I struggled growing up relating to the characters in the books we had available to us. You'd go into the school library and there wasn't a single black author, a single African author. And this is a school in Lambton, Johannesburg.
Mm.
And the only time you see Africa, you see South Africa, you see black people is in the books about apartheid, suffering, death, and the encyclopedia with the emaciated children. And that is not the Africa I live in. So to know that there's not one person, but an entire publishing house and an entire readership that sees the world the way I do and sees literature and where we should be going the same way I do was absolutely amazing. And knowing that my book will be contributing a few pages in that direction is absolutely thrilling.
Well, we're very excited to hear that. So congratulations on that deal. And we also want to ask, what can readers expect from you next? Would you ever revisit Zola, or is that chapter completely closed? And what direction are you going to go in next?
Asking people to follow you for 3 years, it's a lot. And it's amazing that there have been so many people who actually did follow through and people who saw the last book and want to start the series from scratch. Mm. It's absolutely amazing, the support I got. And it's a debut. Like, I'm always like, oh my gosh. But yes, I'm done with Zola. And what anyone can expect from me is always a love story. Always, always, always. Whether it is, I don't know, in a different genre, but it'll always center around a love story. Right now, because I have micro obsessions where I zone into something and it's all I read about. For a while, it was sheep and goats. So,
did not see that coming.
Like, I was obsessed with mini goats and homesteading, like mm-hmm. the Nigerian fainting goats.
Mm-hmm.
I loved them. I wanted them. I was trying to figure out a way to get them. But now I am obsessed with African mythology because you see every other type of mythology being turned into romanticy and fantasy and fiction, but you don't see that happening with African mythology.
Okay. So we're going to what you're basically saying. It will be a love story with an African mythology theme and a goat. This yes. is what we're expecting.
But if it's Southern African, there'll always be a goat because the goat is very culturally significant for us. It's like, what is it somebody said? It says the data bundles to communicate with the ancestors. So if you're doing an ancestral rite, there needs to be a goat slaughtered, take the message. So goats are very significant.
Well, at the beginning, at the top of this episode, I spoke about what I've been watching this week. Have you watched Severance?
No.
Because goats are a big part of it.
So I'm watching Severance tonight.
Well, you're going to have to get right into it and possibly to the end to get really into the goats and the significance of the goats. But one of the mysteries of Severance is what are the goats about? But you're going to have to be patient while you wait for them to come in.
Oh, don't know if I can do that. Patience is not my strong suit.
But that leads me nicely into my next question, which is, what have you been reading or listening to or watching lately that's made an impression on you?
So I have been catching up on Shaka Ilembe because everybody's been talking about it. I haven't had a chance to watch it. So I binge watched that over the past few days. And I am impressed, even though everyone knows how the story ends. We've all seen it. We had to do it in history. We know exactly what's going to happen. But watching it, and I think the music did it for me. Because I also watched Mochachi and another historical epic based in South Africa, and none of them were as big as Shaka Ilembe, or even as, I don't want to say interesting because that might sound mean, but none of them captivated me the way Shaka Ilembe did. And I think it's the music. I really think it's the music that did it. So I've been catching up on that. And obviously, I am a reality TV junkie. I don't think you can write rom-coms and not watch reality TV. I've been watching Married at First Sight, although at this point it's hate watching because I hate absolutely everyone there and everything about them. I really want them to just get off my screen, but I tune in every Sunday evening and watch, and like men watching soccer, I shout at them and yeah, make gestures. And I am reading Octavia Butler's Adulthood Rights. For a long time, I told myself I would only read African writers because I've been starved of them for so long. But because I'm now obsessed with mythology and sci-fi and fantasy and couldn't find that, I turned to Octavia Butler. She's Afro-American, so I feel like she's close enough. And it has been an interesting first few chapters because she gets into the weird right off the bat. It's weird right from the beginning. Like there's no doubt about it. There's no create something semi-normal and get people comfortable, then slowly introduce the weirdness. No, she's weird right off the bat. And I love it.
Brilliant. Well, Zibu, we hope everyone checks out the Zola series. The whole thing is now available because I know there are some readers who will only start a series once the whole thing is out because they don't trust the author to finish it.
Like R.R. Martin.
Yes, it's George R.R. Martin trauma. But the whole series is out. It's published by Pan Macmillan. We hope everyone checks it out because it's very rewarding. Zibu, this has been great. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Zibu.
Gail, I need to ask you, was chatting to Zibu the kick in the bum that you needed to get you writing again?
I think it was. She's just so extraordinary. She's got such a lovely energy. I enjoyed her so much. She's so interesting. So much of what she said resonated with me. So I think maybe we can consider my bum duly kicked.
Wonderful. I look forward to hearing next week about what you've done with that energy. But what in particular did you take from her?
Well, maybe exactly on that bum-kicking theme. When she said that she realized that something that makes you happy can also be something that makes you living. And that resonated a lot for me. I mean, it's a lesson I don't think I've entirely learned yet. But, you know, my history is very much having done the sensible career and still doing a sensible career over prioritizing the writing. And I struggle with it on a daily basis, putting the thing that makes me happy first. And she said it with such joy. And, you know, she's living a different sort of life. I mean, let me be clear, I do not want to homeschool my children. but she's living a different life and she's prioritizing her creativity, and I was very interested in it. And I think that we all do, not all of us, a lot of us struggle with that idea. You work so much of the day. It should make you happy. And for some people doing, you know, all sorts of jobs make all sorts of people happy. You don't have to be a writer for your work to make you happy. My day job actually does make me happy. I love it.
Yes.
But just that prioritizing of happiness, there was my kick in the bum.
And the way she's been able to take the things she loves, which is putting words on a page, and turn it into a career via the ghostwriting, that was very interesting to me, and I think will be to our audience as well.
Very, very interesting. I mean, that ghostwriting was so interesting, so interesting.
And Tony Park mentioned that also. Yes. You know, he's brought in an element of ghostwriting to his career.
Yes. I think more people are doing ghostwriting than we realize, and more people are being ghostwritten. Then we realize.
Yes, very interesting. And it seems as though AI isn't totally replacing that yet. So it's something to think about.
That will be very interesting as well to see the effect AI has on that industry. And you, Fiona, what did you take from that?
Well, I think we were both so fascinated by the aspirational aspect that Zibu talked about in choosing to write the Zola series, that she wanted to show that black women's lives can be joyful, that their love lives can be soft, and that it doesn't have to be all about trauma.
Mm-mm.
Wasn't that interesting?
Yeah, it was so interesting. And that pointing out that we do have kind of this tradition of trauma porn. And, you know, I don't obviously mean that those people who haven't come across the term, we don't mean actual porn, but that kind of romanticizing of trauma.
Yes, and dwelling on it.
And dwelling on it, that is literary.
Mm.
But God forbid you tell a happy story that leaves everyone feeling good at the end of it. That's not literary. I mean, I think that's the thing. But also that writing commercial fiction that people love to read can also be activism and feminism, and she's doing a really important job of modeling healthy love to young black women, and I was fascinated by that.
Yeah, and I was so mad at the reviewer who dared to look down on her for supposedly not writing literature, and that literature has to involve a woman writhing on the floor in pain, you know, in order to be real literature. I mean, what nonsense.
Yeah, what nonsense, but also in a way, have you written a good, readable, grabby commercial fiction if there isn't some man criticizing you for it?
That's true. Maybe it's a badge of honor to have some man in capitals criticizing your work.
I think if you're aiming to write something readable and something gripping and you don't get criticized for not being literary enough and not being serious enough, have you really achieved what you set out to do? So, Zibu, I think it's a badge of honor.
Well, we hope everyone checks out the Zola series. As I said earlier, the whole thing is now available. So please, those books are in stores. Rush out and buy them. You can get the whole trilogy. And we're looking forward to seeing what Zibu comes up with next. If you have already read her books, if you have thoughts on trauma porn versus aspirational romance, if you want to talk about anything we've discussed today, please get in touch. We're on all social media across the board, and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.